Exodus 13, beginning with verse 17, is our text this morning. When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them on the road through the Philistine country, though that was shorter. For God said, if they face war, they might change their minds and return to Egypt. So God led the people around by the desert road toward the Red Sea. The Israelites went up out of Egypt armed for battle. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him because Joseph had made the sons of Israel swear an oath. He had said, God will surely come to your aid, and you must carry my bones up from this place. After leaving Succoth, they camped at Etham on the edge of the desert. By day, the Lord went ahead of them in a pillar of cloud to guide them on their way, and by night, a pillar of fire to give them light, so that they could travel by day or by night. Neither the pillar of cloud by day nor the pillar of fire by night left its place in front of the people. This is the word of God for us, the people of God. We give thanks for His holy word. Last week, I told you the story of Craig Barnes. His father was a pastor. In the summer when he was 16 years old, Craig and his brother, who was a couple of years younger, went to work all summer at a Christian boys' camp as counselors. When they returned home, they discovered that their parents were divorcing. Earlier in the week, his mother had left, and then his father had left, and their home was empty. In his book, Yearnings, Barnes writes about the pain, the anger, and the hurt, and the brokenness of all of that. And he said, out of that inner tumult, he decided to just hobo the country. To just travel around and search and somehow hopefully find himself. He said, regardless of how far he went, he could never run away from the questions of why. Why did I not have a family? Why do I not have goals? Why don't I have a future? But most of all, why has God let me down? He said one Sunday he was hitchhiking and a black man named Stanley Samuels picked him up, Stanley and his wife. They were on their way to Ebenezer Baptist Church, small church, no pastor, no programs. But on that day, it didn't matter. It was fifth Sunday, all day singing and dinner on the grounds. Stanley asked Barnes, did he want to go? And Barnes said, I couldn't think of an excuse quick enough, so I said, sure. As they traveled, Stanley asked Barnes who he was and what he was up to. And Barnes said, I don't have a clue. I don't have a clue. Stanley told him his story. He said, I have been laid off at the cotton mill. I really don't understand why. But he said he believed that God saw him in his distress and that he cared about him and his family. When they arrived at the church, all this food on these long tables, children playing. Someone said the blessing and they sat down to eat. After they'd been eating a while, Barnes said, suddenly Stanley stood and he began to sing Amazing Grace. And he said, by the time they got to the last line of that first verse, everybody else had joined in to sing. Once I was lost, but now I am found. And Barnes said, he began to cry. It was the first time he had cried since his parents had left. And he said the tears wouldn't stop. He said he looked at Stanley Samuel's life and saw a man that had had unjustly his livelihood taken away from him. In some eyes, his manhood stripped away, his ability to provide for his family. And yet, he saw this man finding his security in the grace and love of God. And Barnes said, in him, I discovered I had hope again. And he said, I realized that God's hand was once more on my life. Well, old Pharaoh had finally relented. He had given up. He realized he couldn't win in a battle against God. He realized who he was and who God was. I love that part in the Ten Commandments when Yul Brynner realizes that and he comes back to his wife and he says, Moses is God, he is God. And that's what Pharaoh had done. And he called Moses to him and he said, take the Israelite children, I free them from their slavery. And what we see happening then is known as the Exodus. The children of Israel leaving Egypt on their way to the Promised Land. And as they travel, God said, I will put a pillar of cloud by day in front of you and a pillar of fire by night, and that will be a sign to you that you are never alone, that I am always in your midst, and I am caring for you. And then God did something that was very strange in the Israelites' eyes. He took them, as we say, the long way around. To the Israelites, the simple, most direct route to the Promised Land would have been to go on by the Mediterranean Sea, the coastal route. But rather, God took them through the wilderness. Why? What was God about? Why did He do that? Three reasons. First of all, God knew that along the coastal route, there were Egyptian naval fortresses. And that they would be subjected to military attack. And he knew the Israelites weren't ready for battle yet. They were too weak from the slavery. Secondly, he wanted to take them to the edge of the Red Sea and there let them see the greatest of all miracles when they couldn't escape. Mount on each side, Pharaoh's army, as Pharaoh had a change of heart and he came after them, standing at the Red Sea, the children of Israel absolutely in panic. And then suddenly Moses raises the rod and God parts the Red Sea. They walk across the floor. They look back as Pharaoh's chariots come after them, and then the wall of the water falls down. That proved that God was God. God wanted them to see that. Third reason, he wanted to take them to Mount Sinai, which was known as the Mountain of God. And there he would give them the Ten Commandments and establish His new covenant with them. So what seemed to the Israelites to be an absurd, irrational move on God's part was just the opposite. God was guiding them, doing what He knew was best for them, and guiding them in that way. That, my brothers and sisters, is known as the providence of God. The providence of God. It comes from the root word provido, which has a double meaning. It means to see into the future and to supply. And God has that ability. He has the capability of looking down the road in our lives. He knows what's ahead, and He will guide us if we allow Him along the best route to accomplish what is best for us. God will do that for us if we let Him. It's His providence. He will do for us what we cannot do for ourselves if we trust that guiding hand. Sometimes, as the Israelites saw, God does some outlandish, enigmatic, bizarre things. And He says, don't try to understand it. God says, I don't think like you think. In Isaiah 55:8, God says, my thoughts are not your thoughts. My ways are not your ways. God says, don't try to figure me out. Just trust my guiding hand. I will guide you, and it will work out. I promise. I promise. It's not biblical. You won't find it in the Bible, but it's true. God works in strange, strange ways. And the lives of Christians down through the ages everywhere attest to that. They bear it out. Remember St. Augustine. Great, great man of the early church, saint, a saint, who all of his work and his writings has shaped the church down through the ages and affected and influenced our lives in ways that you and I simply cannot understand. Augustine has impacted your life. What you remember about him is that famous statement when he said, thou hast made us for thyself, O God, and the heart of man is restless until it finds rest in thee. Augustine knew about a restless heart because he was a brilliant man, but he was also a young man who lived his life in selfish greed, lust, and alcohol. His mother, Monica, was a very devout woman, and she prayed for her son day and night. Augustine lived in Carthage. He wanted to travel to Rome, that magnificent city. And Monica begged him not to go, afraid that if he was out of her watch and care, he would sink deeper into sin. One day she received word that Augustine was down by the coastline, awaiting a ship to go to Rome. She quickly hastened there and she fell on her knees and began to cry and hold him by the legs, again begging him not to go, or at least take her with him. And finally, Augustine lied to her. He told her he wasn't going to Rome, that he had just come to the shore to meet a friend. Monica got up and went home. And Augustine said later that night, I set sail for Rome in search of fame and fortune. The next morning, he said, when my mother awoke and discovered what had happened, she went wild with grief, pouring her sorrows into God's ear. But what Monica did not realize was that the hand of God had also made that trip from Carthage to Rome. Because when Augustine arrived in Rome, he heard of the great orator named Ambrose, a man who had no peer in oratorical skills. No one could come close to him in public speaking ability. And Augustine, wanting to develop that part of his life, decided to go hear Ambrose speak. But what he didn't know was that Ambrose was a preacher, a minister. And when he sat down to hear what he thought was a speech, it was actually Ambrose preaching a sermon. And in the hearing of the gospel and the good news, God's grace got a hold of Augustine's heart and changed him dramatically. So what on one hand appeared to Monica to be God not answering her prayer, actually on the other was God indeed answering her prayer. He just did it in a way much different than she ever dreamed. My ways are not your ways, said God. Don't try to figure me out. Just trust me. May I be personal with you for a moment, for a purpose and a connection. After I got out of college, I went to work for an oil company. I worked for them about 6 months, and then I had to go to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri for 6 months active duty on the National Guard. The last week I was there, I received a telegram from my company telling me when my week was up, I was to go to Tampa, Florida to work there. I arrived in Tampa. I left Fort Leonard Wood. It was -1 degree, and got to Tampa. It was 72. When I arrived, they had made reservations for me at the finest motel in Tampa, the Hawaiian Village. I was living on an expense account, soon to have a company car and more money than this old poor boy ever had. And as each day and each night went by, I looked around and I saw what temptation was about me. And I knew that I would have to make a decision about what my priorities in my life would be. So Wednesday afternoon when I got in from work, I made the decision I'd go to church that night. I was Methodist at that time, always been a Methodist. Back in those days, Methodists didn't have church on Wednesday night. They do now, but they didn't then. So I looked for a Baptist church in the Yellow Pages, found the one that was closest to that motel, Palmacia Baptist Church, went to prayer meeting, as they say. And the pastor there, Ralph Stone, and I struck up a very close friendship. And we began to meet a couple of times a week and talk. First thing I knew, he said something about me joining their church. I said, fine. He said, you have to be immersed. I didn't know what that was. You have to be baptized by immersion. He told me what Sunday night I was to be there to meet folks. I got in. They threw me this robe. Told me to wait on these steps. And I saw people go underwater. I said, how did he slip me into this? I made the mistake of cavalierly mentioning to Ralph one day in a conversation that there had been a couple of times that I thought God wanted me in the ministry. That's a bad move of that man. He wouldn't let up with that. About every other time we got together, he'd say, Bill, when are you going to say yes to God? Bill, why won't you go in the ministry? And I always had an excuse. I'd say, God wanted me. I've known since I was 13 years old I wanted to be a businessman. He'd ask me again, I'd say, you know, I can influence a lot more people for Christ in the business world because a lot of them don't go to church. And he'd come back the next week and ask. Finally, I got a notice from the company. They wanted me to transfer to Greensboro. And Ralph called me up and asked me to have lunch with him on the last day I was there. Nice restaurant. In the middle of the week, we had lunch, and they had cloth napkins. But it was a setup. We got through eating, great meal. He leaned across the table and he said, Bill, why won't you say yes to God? And I'd had in my back pocket the trump card, the one excuse, because I knew he was going to crank the pressure up one day. The one reason that I knew once I told him, they'd hush him up forever. And when he asked me that question, I leaned back up and I said, because, Ralph, I don't feel worthy. He looked me dead back in the eye and he said, if you felt worthy, God wouldn't call you. How do you argue with that? I left and came to Greensboro. And God kept knocking on my heart. And I eventually said, Lord, if you're crazy enough to want me, I'm crazy enough to say yes. And in these 26 years in the ministry, I've had a front row seat at the invitation of people to watch God flash down in all His brilliance and work miracles in people's lives and change them. And I consider myself one of the most fortunate people in all the world. And it all started in the yellow pages of the back of a telephone book in a motel in Tampa, Florida. Who would ever thunk it? My ways are not your ways. Arnold Fine tells the story of how he learned this. He said one day he found a wallet on the street, picked it up. There was no identification in there, only $3 and a letter. The letter was postmarked 60 years before that. He knew this must be a special letter, so he determined somehow he would find out who owned the wallet. The addressee had on the envelope had been worn out through the years, so he read the letter. And in reading it, it was a Dear John letter from a woman named Hannah to a man named Michael, ending their relationship. He knew all the more he had to get that letter to that letter and that wallet to its owner. The return address was readable, so he called a telephone operator, told her the story, and asked her for the number. She said, I don't know, but maybe I can help you. Please wait. And a few minutes she came back and she said, the party on the other end will talk with you. He told them the story and they said, we bought this house from Hannah's mother years ago. And she was in a nursing home then and they told him the nursing home name. So he called it and said, well, Hannah's mother has died. We don't know where Hannah is, but we know some folks who used to come with her to visit her mother. We have their number. So he called them. And they said, yes, we know where Hannah is. She's in a retirement home. 10 o'clock at night, Fine headed to that retirement home, saw the director and told him of his dilemma. The director said, Hannah is probably in the day room on the third floor where she lives. She liked to stay up late at night. So he went into the day room, and there was Hannah. And he said, I found this envelope and this letter. And she said, yes, I wrote that letter. It was to Michael Goldstein. I loved him so, and he loved me. But I was only 16, and my mother said I was too young to be in love, and she forbade me to see him. She said, I loved him deeply. I'd never marry him. I guess no one ever measured up to Michael. If you see him, tell him I think of him often. Fine then walked out, still frustrated. And the guard was standing there, and he said, did that old lady help you? And he said, well, I have this wallet. I'm trying to find the owner. And the guard looked at it, and he said, that's Mr. Goldstein's wallet. He said, what? He said, it belongs to Michael Goldstein. He's always losing. And he said, I found it 3 times. He said, you know him? He said, sure. He lives on the 8th floor. He said, will you take me to him? He said, yeah, he stays up late. He's probably in the day room. He went to him. I said, Mr. Goldstein, I found this wallet, and I need to tell you, I read this letter in an effort to try to find its owner. And he said, when I got that letter, my world ended. I loved Hannah so much. He said, I've never married. I've just never met anyone quite like Hannah. And Fine said, Michael, I know where she is. Come with me. And so they went to the day room of the 3rd floor, and Michael Goldstein walked up to the woman in the rocking chair and said, Hannah. She turned and looked, adjusted her glasses, but didn't see anything. And he said, Hannah, it's Michael. Michael Goldstein. And she stood and said, Michael? And they came together and embraced. And Fine said he stood by the nurses, both of them wiped their eyes, and he said to her, isn't it strange how our good Lord works in our lives? 2 days later, he got a phone call. Would you like to come to a wedding? 3 weeks later, on a Sunday afternoon, he was part of a wedding party. As he stood there and watched a 78-year-old man and a 76-year-old woman, groom and bride, come together as husband and wife, and consummated a love affair that had lasted 60 years. My brothers and sisters, the hand of God is on your life, and you can trust that. You can trust that.